irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Abracadabra, Create What You Speak, with Ilan Azulay, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Abracadabra, Create What You Speak. I'm Ilan Azulay, spiritual mentor and a sound therapist for you who are ready to reclaim your power, bring your gifts to the world, and shine with love and no fear. This program is a program of empowerment, bringing people from all walks of life who are shining their gifts to the world and bringing their light to the society. Today, I'm honored and grateful to have a lyricist, an artist, a musician, a breath worker who inspired me for many years through her art and through her words. And I love words. Julie Flanders, she's an award-winning Amazon number one best-selling poet and songwriter whose work bridges genres. She's co-founder and lyricist of the influential recording artist October Project. She's also committed to choral work, collaboration with other artists in music, multimedia, live events as a way to heal both the individual heart to contribute to the greater shared society. One of her works, The Book of Rounds, is 21 Songs of Grace, a work she created with composer Emil Adler and arranger Keiji Ishiguri, premiered with Chorus Austin and has been performed by the Yale Camerata and the New York Choir Caradorian, director James John. It is a fugue of positive messages, was released as a full-length choral recording with Chorus Austin. Julie is an expert in creative leadership, self-expression, and change. She provides creative business consulting, excellence training, whole life coaching, balanced lifestyle approaches, and dream achievement. And this is why we are here, to achieve our dreams. And as Mike Bohm said in the LA Times, Flanders and Adler create lush musical architecture. Flanders' lyrics don't shy from occasional reference to the Bible, Shakespeare, and ancient Greek myths. At the same time, her core subjects are anything but arcane. Her characters are typically caught up in high-stakes searches for love and spiritual awareness. So without further ado, I'm really excited and honored to have Julie join us. Hi, Julie. How are you? Thank you for being here.
So nice to be here with you.
Thank you. So wonderful to be here with you. So you're here. We've been talking this morning and now we're continuing our conversation. I was introduced to your work with Emil through October Project, magnificent music, so bad it disbanded in that format, but it's still going and you're still producing. So, but there's so much to talk about what you're doing, about your spiritual work, about your heart work, about this project that we are going to announce that it premieres next week. So next week on Thursday, and there's so many things that we want to talk about. So please tell me, tell us, How did you start writing? I mean, when did you start writing? Tell us a little bit about you. I'm sure you'll do a better job than I did just now.
I'm not sure about that. But, well, one of my aunts tells me that as soon as I could get a pencil and a little piece of paper, I started writing poems and songs immediately. So the words to me, my father used to sing to me a lot. He had a very, very beautiful, deep, wonderful voice and sang to me every night. And I think between his love of song and my mother's love of whimsy and rhyme and Ogden Nash and Dr. Seuss, who I know is out of favor right now, but, you know, a lot of my childhood was spent in poetry as a sort of a nighttime go-to-bed story. And so very, very early in life, I knew I was a writer. I knew I was a poet, and it got fed back to me by the environment I was in that was true.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. So then you continued. Did you continue? Was it obvious that you're going to be in poetry? Obvious that you're going to be in art from your parents' standpoint, from your standpoint growing up?
It was obvious I was going to be a writer. So I consider myself a writer, though songwriting is something that I am best known for. You know, I write all the time. I write tremendous amount. So I feel like my father was a journalist. And so I had the natural music of writing inside me from my family. It was sort of just something that was true. Words were very important to him and to me. Words were always my instrument in a way. Like I always enjoyed the play of words and how they change depending on which word sits next to which word and how.
Yeah.
I was fascinated by that. Like, I remember in high school that, you know, I wanted to get a dictionary of homonyms. I wanted to know the origins of words. Where did they come from? That kind of thing. Because words tell a story. They travel, you know. They travel from culture to culture. They tell the whole history of humanity. If you follow the words back, you get back to the first sounds we made that had meaning to one another. And when I was young, that's what I wanted to know. That's what I wanted to study. Where did the language come from? What was the true mother tongue? And it's it's music.
Music. Well, I was thinking that you were talking about where the origins of letters, of words. Mm-hmm. You know, there are words in English that originate from, I mean, languages back in Babylon, from Babylon started 70 languages, you know, so it was.
Yeah. So English is completely watermarked with other cultures and other times, you know. It's
just Hebrew also, especially.
Right. There's a lot of exciting layers and nuance. I mean, I know you speak several languages, so you know, you understand that translation is fascinating. Just the idea that, you know, you can read a Rumi poem, and if you read Coleman Barks, it's completely different than some of the other translations where it doesn't really animate.
This is wonderful.
Poetry is a kind of animation of spirit, using words to make the spirit dance, I think.
Totally agree with you. You know, it's amazing. Words, I love words. I love words. I love how they sound. I love how they roll off your tongue. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like eating chocolate, right? Mm-hmm. It's like eating chocolate. It's like eating chocolate. You feel how everything swirls around in your cheeks. And it's like, it has this, and some words sound like they are, you know, like.
Oh, yeah. English is good for whatever you mean. I mean, I'm so glad I was born to English, because it's a difficult language to learn if it's not something that you have first, because of the complexity. I mean, the fact that English is such a bastard language, so the spelling doesn't make sense, the pronunciation doesn't make sense.
For example,
all puns, you know,
like for example, when I say you, right? Mm-hmm. In Hebrew, you have you for her, for him, for they, for us, for them, for it, you know.
Yeah. Even when I think about, because I work a lot with neurolinguistics, and so let's say somebody keeps referring to their self conversation, where they're talking to themselves and they say, you know, you to themselves, and if you simply ask that person, so who is it that's talking?
That's right.
You know, who's the I there? Is it you or is it someone else's voice? You know, it's very interesting. Our internal conversation also carries the mark of the linguistics we grew up with. And linguistics are just incredibly powerful for healing.
Fascinating. Also in Hebrew, a slang, like a common conversations between Israelis, they will talk, you know, when they want to talk about themselves, they'll say, you know, you go, you do this, you do that, and then you find out that it's like that, and then you, it drives you nuts. You know, stuff like that.
Yes. They're talking about themselves, but they're using the second person. It's very, very interesting. And different languages do that differently, and you realize that's why people have so much trouble, even two people sharing a household use words differently. Its meaning is lost, and it's amazing that we can communicate at all. But I feel that in song, what happens is the words go and they unlock in the heart of the listener. And so for me, though I have a meaning for a song, it doesn't matter my meaning. It only matters what happens for the listener. And if they listen into a song and that song unlocks for them, I've had people tell me stories about songs that I've written I'm like, that's so much better than the story I had. Can I use that story? That's a really good story for that song, you know? And I found that even over time, I was very late to singing. So over time, what I found was that the relationship between a writer in a song and a singer in a song, or even a producer in a song, is each different and unique. So as a singer encountering a song, the meaning is very different than as a writer expressing a song.
It's like a composer that sings versus a composer that doesn't sing.
Very, very different. And a lot of times I think that the standards of the song could be higher from a composer who doesn't sing to some extent. But singing is a really, really challenging art, a beautiful art. It's like acting on a tightrope. You know, it's the best singers have very big job to resonate meaning just through their being, through the breath that comes in and out of their body.
Yes, yes, yes. Wow. You know, so I'm going back to what I want to talk about the what's coming up Thursday, right? Mm-hmm. And we'll get much of that, because this is really a breath work, isn't it?
It is. It's extraordinary, because it is such a fundamental topic. The Book of Rounds is absolutely a work of, spiritual presence. It's a work that's meant to help people and surround them with like a lullaby of protection. So, you know, to me, that whole sense of creating a soundscape that protects or freshens or enlightens or enlivens people is the same thing you're doing with your sound work. You know, it's when you get into the center of a healing sound, there's nothing like it.
There's nothing. Sound is the ultimate medicine for body and soul.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of the things that we value so much, like the computer or the phone or the whatever it is, would not be valuable without music. There's none of the technology that we use that would be valuable without music.
That's true. You know, babies, think about babies that are in the womb of the mother, and they listen to songs.
They
flip, and then they remember the songs. Mm-hmm. They remember the songs. They remember the songs when they are born. And I remember singing a certain song to my son when he was born, because I was singing to him all this time through the belly of his mom, of my wife at that time.
Okay.
And then he would like, as it would come out, and then he would relax, you know. And so it was definitely. And at that time, I wasn't. Oh, he was born during the time. Yeah, he was born during the peak of my infatuation and love with October Project.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, I was born in 96.
And, amazing. So he's the same age as my son.
I'm sorry?
He's the same age as my son.
Yeah, 95. Oops. I hope he doesn't see that.
I said it's 95 tipping into 96, like December 23rd. So
okay, yeah. So that's right. And it is wonderful. Music is bridging worlds as you're writing, and especially during these times, what I call the coronic era, and this coronic era where we are really facing with a lot of masking, shutting our words, shutting our mouths, shutting our breath, and this premiere that we're talking about, that is coming Thursday, next Thursday. Mm-hmm. This is a work of releasing, to talk about the breath, how breath is really is so integral part of our existence. I mean, without breath. Yeah. We don't exist.
We are the breath.
We are the breath.
You know, it's the most fundamental aspect of the life cycle. It recurs many, many times every minute. We are freshening our breath. And if we're not, if we're holding our breath, it's a completely different experience of life. So,
totally.
You know, having a freedom in the breath, having a full breath, having a full inhale and a full exhale. I mean, it's interesting how trauma causes people to inhale and then hold it, you know, and it's really in the release on the exhale where we sing, where we speak, where we say, I love you, You know, the inhale and the exhale are different universes, but they cycle, and a person who's breathing in a healthy way is going to go right through that cycle without a pause. But most of us go in, hold, out, hold, you know, or we stutter in our breath. We have all kinds of modern habits that come from the world that we live in that doesn't encourage us to the most fundamental things like eating in a healthy way, breathing in a healthy way. You know, we're not built to that.
Yeah.
Society.
You know, the most freedom that we have is in the exhale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we have this freedom during there. And breath is really important. I work with it when I work with people here, and breathing. Mm-hmm. It's the difference between shallow breathing and especially women, a lot of women breathe shallowly, if that's a word.
Women are taught not to take up space, and to really command the full power of your lungs takes you out of deference and into assertion in a positive way. You know, in nature, all the animals, all the female animals, they breathe deeply. And there's no sense that a lion shouldn't roar, you know. But human females, you know, I think that there's a lot of fear in the human female.
Well, no surprise. No surprise. For thousands of years, we've been, the women have been suppressed to.
And women as representative of that feminine yin or receptive or life-giving force, you know, that we need to protect in ourselves. I mean, men carry the feminine also. So it's really about protecting the human element that balances us and lets us, you know, both do, but also to be able to be, to be able to receive life and not just do life, get life.
Yes, exactly.
You know,
we're talking about this holding our breath, and that's the name of it's written by composer Carlos Cordero and you and Julie Flanders.
Yes.
And it's an a cappella of soprano, alto, tenor and bass. Right.
Yes.
Work exploring the worldwide need and fear to breathe together right now using the lens of breath. It's just fascinating. It's just fascinating. The link, all the links, all the information is listed below here. It's a free event to join, and it's on, right? Am I right? Okay.
Yes, and if you're watching this, you know, in the future, the video premiere will stay up. So there's
wonderful.
If you miss the event, you can still catch the musical part. It will be recorded. So
it is. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about that, because then I want to go back to the beginning, but I want first to start with this, which we're here for today.
The thing that hasn't happened yet, which is very important to me, because I'm usually very hands-on in terms of the visual, whatever visuals are put to my songs, I participate very much in that if I can. There's been a couple of times where I couldn't, and it was, But in this, for me, every time I write is very visual and very immersive. My background is in theater, and so it's very 3D, you know, that sense of being immersed in something so that you don't feel a distance between yourself and a piece of art. You feel the art.
So you visualize what you're before you're writing.
Yeah.
Wow.
A lot. And so this piece is being created by conspirare, which means to breathe with, and is one of the best choirs in the world. It's helmed by Craig Hella Johnson, who's written beautiful pieces, including a piece called Considering Matthew Shepard. And he his work in choir is just beautiful. If you ever have a day where you need to bring music into your heart and soul, go just look up Conspirare and you'll find all kinds of beautiful work there. They're Grammy winning. They're fantastic. So the piece was commissioned. There was a solicitation for composers to find a living poet and create a piece that would address what was happening. And I think we first found out about it around June, maybe. I can't remember exactly when, but I think it was just before George Floyd was killed. Because that added another layer, what happened after that added another layer of consideration to what we were working with.
I see.
But Carlos Cordero is from Venezuela, and he's an award-winning, beautiful young composer. And he had read a book of my poetry, and he got in touch and asked me if I would be willing to do this proposal with him. And so I said, yes, because I knew his work. So we began to talk about what's important now. And Carlos said, I would like to talk about breath because it's what singers must use to make sound. And we can't breathe together. We can't sing together. And I was like, I can't believe you're saying this because I've been having the same consideration. So we worked for quite a deep, substantial period of time to consider all the ways that breath is at the heart of what's happening in the world right now.
It is.
And it was at the heart of the global pandemic. The people were holding their breath from fear. I was in New York during the worst of COVID-19, and I heard people coughing themselves to death in my building and the buildings next to me. I heard sirens every 7 to 17 seconds for a month. And I went out in Central Park, which is my backyard, and saw, you know, bodies being put in refrigeration trucks, and they built a hospital in a field. It was very grim. So that was a surrounding context. And so what we wanted to do was we knew that singers would probably not, you know, there was no possibility of the piece being sung in the next year. So we wanted to create something that addressed that too, because 54 million people sing at least once a week in a group in America. Which many people do not realize. It's not just a fun activity. It's something that holds communities together. It's something where people express themselves and hold their life together. And so we really wanted to deal with the interruption of life that was caused by people not being able to be with their loved ones, old people being isolated and having to go to the hospital by themselves, all these kinds of things. And so we used breath as a lens for that. And then there was the words that George Floyd and other men have spoken upon being killed were, I can't breathe.
I can't breathe, yes.
And, you know, the notion that in that moment they were not helped by anyone. And so we wanted to catch that feeling of the loss of compassion that's been happening in our society and the need for it. The need for us to look at one another and see a human being and see a person that we give care to.
This is so wonderful. This is so beautiful. Thank you for being there and creating that in this fashion.
And then what we really wanted to do was we didn't want to leave the story, the idea that we are in a hopeless or despairing place, even though probably Carlos and I were both in a pretty hopeless, despairing place as artists creating the piece. Yes. We decided that we would have the courage to move from grief to hope. The notion of breath coming back and breathing together, being together, the future, the horizon of people learning from this experience and valuing things that we could very much take for granted before this pandemic. So the
very much so.
Yeah. It's very short piece. It's 5 minutes, but in that 5 minutes, you really get to take a journey.
Yeah. So you have how many singers?
It's 26 singers.
26 singers.
I mean, it'll be the first time I see it. We'll be the first time everybody sees it. We're going to have a Zoom where we can all gather and talk and have feedback with the artists. There's another piece that's performed as well called Calling Across. By Brian Newhouse and Kyle Peterson, who's a wonderful composer. And there's going to be the chance for people to all be together watching it and then coming back and talking about it, even though, you know, if you could do that live, you'd be in a space and then you'd have an intermission and you'd have maybe a glass of wine or something.
This is wonderful.
This will be, you know, you get to do that at home. But all the singers, really, they have to each sing in their own space. And then we have to create a choir from that. So Craig Hella Johnson will be harvesting these beautiful voices from some of the best singers in the world and putting them together. And hopefully it'll all sound like it happened in one space at one time.
Yes, yes. Oh, wow, wow. And then that's not the next day. There is a next day that you were talking about, where people from the different parts of the world that can come together.
Well, the next day after that premiere, we're announcing another. One really big virtual choir and one really small virtual choir of just one person this last year. Exactly. But we did a virtual choir of joy last summer.
Yes.
October project. My creative partner, Marina Balika, and I.
She's wonderful. She's wonderful.
She's a wonderful singer, wonderful human being, my best friend for my whole life, you know.
This is good.
And she and I got this harebrained idea that we would do a virtual choir and we would try to help singers and give people opportunity. And, you know, we were very inspired by Eric Whitaker, who was kind enough to jump on a call and help us. And we ended up with 163 people from all over the world singing this choir of joy in the middle of despair. And people were singing and dancing and playing instruments, and it turned into quite a hullabaloo.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful piece.
It's really beautiful. Wonderful. I couldn't be happier with it. It's just also so strange to see, like, just people I don't even know. I don't know these people personally, and they're just from all over the world, and they feel like my family. They feel like friends. I love them so much. I love that piece so much.
That's how it felt. That's how it felt when I watched that piece. That's how it felt. So here is joy. I want you to see that.
Dancing.
This is just, I felt, it really felt like a home. It really felt like a very homey kind of, everybody in their corner, it just felt very, very, it was very beautiful. It was very beautiful to watch that.
Yeah.
I watched it like, I think this was like the fifth time I've been watching it.
Oh, that's so good. I love our editor, Ulrich Vilbois, did the editing, and
thank you.
Came up with some really wonderful, we love working with him. We collaborate with him a lot. And he just came up with some wonderful ways to convey circles and the fact that they're rounds. And
yes, yes.
I love the baby Maya at the beginning. She's
yes, yes. Oh, it's so perfect. The baby was like, it was like almost like a rhythmic. Her movements were almost like we were rhythmic. We're like part of like they set perfectly in time. Now I don't know if he maybe scooped the video a little bit or first, but it was perfect.
Perfect.
It was just like she was like
that's Ulrich's magic. But I also love that baby. And her grandmother told me that her grandmother and mother watched it with her. She watched herself, and she just ecstatic. She had no idea how that could have happened, and she just loved it herself. I wish that in itself would have been a video, is watching her watch herself and all that joy.
Wow. I want to go back. So this is the way that I see that in comparison to October Project, to the lyrics. I mean, the music by Emil, he's a wonderful, I love his music. He's just so ingenious, by the way. He's just like, just touches something and it's like. but there is a difference. There is a difference in the lyrics. There is a difference.
Very different.
You obviously know that. I mean, people have talked to you about this so many times. There is this kind of dark, gothic almost, in some songs at least. Let's say in Bury My Lovely, which is one of the songs, the first time I heard it, I fell from the floor to the chair. Mm-hmm. Literally. Like, you know, it was just like, I was mesmerized. Of course, also the presentation of it and the singer of Mary Fall at that time, she was at that time the leader of October Project, the lead singer at least.
The
lead singer.
The leader of October Project.
Yeah, the lead singer. And it was just, first of all, it felt to me as if you wrote the words and Emil composed the music to the singer. That's how it felt to me. It felt like it felt very together. Mm-hmm. And then so that's the first thing that got me in. But then I was and then the words, and so the music drew me in, and the voice drew me in, and then the words. And at that time, I think I was in my mid-20s or something. I don't remember, something like that. Mid-to-late 20s. I wasn't as comfortable with my gifts or comfortable with words and comfortable with my voice and so forth. So it took me a while to get to the words. But once I got it, I think this was the first time that I really start listening to words in a different fashion, in a different way, listening to them from my heart, because it moved so many things within me. Now, so Bury My Lovely, I want to play the song first, okay. And then we can talk about this. So please tell me about that. Please tell me about that song. What is going on there? Where are you coming from? Where were you? I mean, is it?
Well, I think the song could be listened to different ways. I think that Josh Taft, who co-wrote the storyboard for that with me, the video, I think he understood it really, really well. And I think he's an exceptional director. His work is extraordinary. And I think he's gone on to make some beautiful commercials as well. I think he was, but he really understood the song visually the way I would have hoped somebody would understand that song, which is there's a dreamlike, archetypal, universal horror song. And haunting to the song. And the song is a sort of, it's a dream, but it has a resolution. And the resolution is that there is in every human being an ability to overcome, to move past or through dark experiences into something better. And through experiences that we have, we become strong, we become healers, we become other things. And so I think the song is really about that. It's about finally speaking a truth that may have been secret or hidden and letting that truth be opened.
Yes. Yeah. So it is definitely, did you think about that song, what you're telling me now, back then at the same time, or is it something that evolved now as you're looking back at the song?
I don't really think about my songs so much. I like listen for them and I try to render what comes. I don't think about the song. You know, it's like I have to tell what a song is about afterward. I have to think about that because it helps people to frame their experience. But
yes,
I didn't want that song on the album. I was really opposed to it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Did it reveal too much?
Yeah, it felt revealing. It felt like it, you know, I always try to reveal. I think art is about risk. And we took different risks. So for me, the risks there were very different than the risk of the book around. So the risk of the book around, you know, I'm a pretty sophisticated songwriter and I have a lot of technique and I have a lot of skill. And I've decided not to show that off. Yeah. I rarely try to show off because I think it ruins the song. And so Emil and I will often do something beautiful or clever or an extraordinary like twist of pyrotechnics. And then we go, this sucks. You know, this is like too fucking smart and we're not doing it. And we bring the song back to its emotional simplicity. A lot of the lyrics that were more passionate and poetic got onto the first two albums there.
Return to Me.
Yeah, people know. People know that song, like, for example, Falling Farther In is a tour of force. There's a lot going on in those. In the technical creation and the technical production of those. And hopefully nobody hears that but musicians, but a lot of our fans are musicians, are poets, are themselves incredible creators. So they hear it and we're very satisfied that they do, but they don't have, nobody has to. Hopefully you can just feel the song, but the Book of Rounds is a very different vocabulary and that vocabulary, I became a mother. So I wasn't just a person in the world. I now had a different experience of myself and the vocabulary we use to make a child safe is different than the vocabulary used to discharge evil.
That's right.
To express what happened to us or others we know. You know, for example, I know people whose parents have gone through war and never told them until very much later in life. Right. And I think that for me, the Book of Rounds was a completely ego-free experience of writing. It's very technical because every round has a lyrical round and a musical round, and they form infinity circles. And so there's stuff inside, like a mirror inside a mirror inside a mirror in every song. But the words sound very, very simple. And I even had a woman, because people always want to tell you what they think, come up to me and say, you know, tell me how simplistic my writing style was. And she wasn't sure why anyone would want to sing it, because, you know, the around to her was just childish.
Really?
I don't even feel insulted. I just feel like you missed the point, you know, whereas I think if she'd been talking about something that was, you know, a work that I really was like, wow, I'm showing off, I might've actually felt it in my ego. But here I knew this, I knew that I had channeled what was meant to come, these positive messages. I knew that they didn't show off. I knew that the vocabulary was a child's vocabulary. It was meant to be. And I knew that they really took the risk of beauty. They took the risk of care. They took the risk of caring too much, being sincere. They took risks that we don't take in our society. They took the risk of love and care and being a sap, you know, like the one who cares too much. And I thought to myself, okay, that's me. I always care too much, you know, but I'm okay for people to see that now.
Well, this is wonderful. Book Around. There is a trailer. There is a promo that I want to show of the Book Around, where you and Emil are talking. Marina is talking there too.
Yeah, Marina is very instrumental to the Book Around.
So I'm always trying to find that tipping point where the music and the lyric come together to make something greater than either.
In this garden I know who you are, blood in the dust of a fallen star.
The Book of Rounds is a project that tries to create a meditative state.
Now, I think of Rounds as joyous. I love Rounds. The messaging is intended to harmonize the listener. Rounds make me excited. They're fun.
When you're singing it, you love singing it over and over again because the physical act puts you in that Zen state.
We can comfort each other and start.
I'm always starting with something beautiful, something wonderful, something carefully wrought and finished. And my biggest thing is I don't want to screw it up.
Light will move through broken places, soften the edges of empty spaces.
The project grew very, very organically.
We actually conceived of them as three sets of seven. The first set, the simple type of round. Second set, a little more adventurous. And the third set, accompanied.
We put out this original group of seven on our own. We have this whole new crop of rounds that no one's ever heard that are as fun to sing as any you've ever heard.
And so each of those would be wonderful listening experiences, seven at a time.
It creates a kind of an avalanche of sound and harmony.
Yes, if you need a world to belong to, look around, you're already home, and what you seek, you've already found. Turn around to me, you will see no reason to belong.
I'm Keiji Ishiguri, and I am the arranger and the pianist for the Book of Rounds.
We began to connect with Keiji originally thinking that he might make just some simple choices about the rounds and how voices would enter and start this swell of experience. And he got very excited about doing a lot more than that. Keiji came to us really through our Yale connection, I'd say, most of all. One of the great joys of putting together the Book of Rounds was returning to Yale.
Dance in a circle, clapping our hands. Life is a cartwheel, life is a handstand. For no reason, amazing happiness. For no reason, crazy with joy. For no reason, crazy with joy.
feels very close up, and yet you could imagine it in the world's largest cathedral with 1,000 voices, and it would work either way. We have known each other since we were teenagers. We love what we do so much. We feel so lucky to be together still and to be making music. I guess we live in a real living harmony of experience together, of which this is a very direct expression. This is a very important piece to me personally. I love this piece, and I love what it offers to the listener and to singers. We've enjoyed producing this piece and inviting other people to come and collaborate and play with us and sing and create with us in the frame of the Book of Rounds.
Ready then? Will you be ready then? Will you be ready then?
This is beautiful, and it feels like you went from self, let's say, era of Bury My Lovely, let's say, for that. And then you're going into, as you said, you're a mother. So now you're caring for the other. And now you're in the world. So it's like the spiritual journey that we all go. But in your case, you're going through this spiritual journey of self, other, and the world.
Yeah, I don't know that I write so much from self. I really write from archetypes. So I think it might be that the archetype I was writing in at the time of the first album is different than the archetype I was writing in for the second album.
Okay.
Than the archetype of the Book of Rounds. And
yes.
Different than, I mean, I have another project of Rounds that's going to be around the notions of people who have been dispossessed of their homes all around the world and been thrown out of their house by a war or, you know, trying to cross a border but having nowhere to go. We live a lot with many, many women and children wandering this world in terror and not having a place to go. And I find that to be abhorrent. And so, you know, my next project will be trying to hold the horror and the wonder in one place.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so, I mean, it's pretty much
horror and wonder.
Yeah, the horror of circumstance and the wonder of the human heart. That
a child, like a child, the wonder of a child that has no.
Yeah.
Wow, this is what a blessing that you are in this world.
I think of Hansel and Gretel and how someone once said to me that Hansel and Gretel had been adopted into a theater work as a metaphor for children who were released into forests by their parents and told to run to avoid the Nazis. And I was
like, yes.
Very powerfully frightening and just unbelievable that it's true that children are still being, you know, in Cambodia that happened. It happened in Rwanda. It happens now in certain places in the world, in Africa and Myanmar.
It happens in the U.S. too.
And in the U.S. Yes, exactly. Well,
and trafficking and all this kind of thing is like
that, you know, we would like to believe that we are free of that. And it's,
This is the time where people are enslaved more than any other time in history.
And it's completely shocking. And so I feel that art and love are the defiant energies. Love is the defiant energy. Refusing to hate, refusing to hold it, forgiving. Yeah. That's a very powerful, strong, frightening thing to do.
It is frightening because it takes us out of what we've been indoctrinated.
Yeah.
It goes with patriarchy. It's like goes hand in hand of the fear, the war, the patriarchy's influence, the domination, putting the thumb down, the bullying, all these things that are going around, all these things that are part of that construct. And it is scary because, and the thing is that it is when we are, I know when I am in the space of expansion and love, it is so, Then I remember how easy it is.
Yeah.
Only then you can remember when it is so easy. When I say you, only then you can remember when it is so easy to be in that space. But when in the space of fear, it appears to be so hard. No, I can't. How can I choose to be in a good space when this is happening?
Yes. And I feel that as a parent, that was one of the great lessons for me, was to be given the gift of another human being framing love for me, where there was no limit to the amount of love.
Yes.
For my son. And I learned from that feeling of no limit to the amount of love is something we can have for everyone, for anyone.
Forever.
You just have to be to your beloved, though your beloved teaches you how.
Yes.
You know, Abel's my beloved too, but it's different to love a man than to love your own child. I mean,
It's different.
Yeah. It's so easy. It's so easy to love my son. There's, you know, it's a gift to love like that. I find that's a great gift in my life and in my work. Although I would say that as a mother, there's also been constraint to my work, because I do have a very dark edge and dangerous sense of what I can explore, you know, as a poet, as an actor, as a performer. I mean, I don't fear what other people, I'm not scared to go in the basement as an artist. I'm not scared to explore and provoke. But as a mother, as a person walking around, you know, I like to be appropriate. I had a lot.
So how do you harmonize? Not necessarily balance, because many times people think of balance.
Yeah.
How do you harmonize going between as a mother and saying, okay, now I'm an artist, now I'm a poet, yeah, now I'm a mother. How do you differentiate that in your writing?
Elon, or do you? That's a great question, and I realize that, you know, I wonder if a group of women my age were to have that conversation, or a group of women 20 years younger or 30 years younger would have that conversation, if the conversation would be different, because, you know, I'm the first woman in a lot of situations, and women now, they have more of a sense of balancing ways of being in the world and being a mother. But when I became a mother, that was very divided.
Yes. You know?
And for me, it's that I have to hold the notion that there's contexts, and that my son's context and him growing up was really important to me. And I wanted him to have to sort of own his territory and not be defined by us or what we did in the world, but to be defined in his world, his way. And so we really let that happen. But now that he's a grown man and has his own world, there's still an inner inhibition to me to really be as weird as I am, you know, like I'm much weirder than I would want, you know, him to see. So there's a sense of, like, if I had to think of an audience of, you know, someone that might be, you know, that I might be afraid to find out who I am because of that. And so I think that's like something interesting to actually explore. I have a friend who's, she's going to be turning 80 this year, and she was taken off the road because of COVID, but she was in a Broadway show touring in Anastasia. And she's her name is Joy Franz. She's a wonderful, wonderful singer and performer. And we got together, and I was saying, you know, if you at 80 started to do this comedy show, I would write it for you. And I'm going to call it Bad Grandma.
Oh, man, that's amazing. That's hilarious.
You go nuts, you know? And we just started thinking about how many ways could grandma be bad, you know? And I thought to myself, oh, my God, giving permission to an 80-year-old woman to just
to be bad,
streak through a dinner party, or, you know, come and just embarrass everyone in a family setting. It just delights me. So I think maybe I'll just express it as a writer and put it in. I think my greatest gift really might be comedy, that you wouldn't know it from all the melancholy I put in the world. But I have an urge to that right now. I want to write Bad Grandma and star all my friends in it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we come to a place in time in our life where things really, we see like what it is. We see what's important in creation, what's important in our life, and what's important in regards to what people may say, what people may not say. Oh, And then we come to this place of, you want to write bad grammar.
I do.
Exactly. And you had to go through all these stages.
Because I want to be bad grandma. It's really the truth. I just really do. But, you know, I might stick to that. I might just have someone else be bad grandma who really can do it. But, you know, I think I have lots of ideas for bad grandma. I know things you can do, you know.
And bad grandma can be totally different from what I think bad grandma is. And it is, and that is the what's hilarious wow. about it.
Oh, but it's so funny. Because bad grandma knows who she is. She's going to be.
Man.
And it's not going to be how you want her to be. It's going to be. I don't even know what bad grandma would want me to write for her, but I know that she will definitely always want to be the star of the
interview. Man.
You know, living in New York, I really grew up in a place where, you know, women can assert themselves more than almost many places in the world, but there's still a masculine element to that, right? In other words, it's asserting yourself in a male world, a male way in business a lot of the time, as opposed to it being, you know, a more feminine approach to the world that still hasn't happened, where, you know, the things that make someone a wonderful mother get valued in a society.
Yeah. As a mother, you know, this is the thing. Today as a mother, there is almost like the mother has its own, the mother term and role has its own world. Mm-hmm. But anything else that has to do with nurturing, mm-hmm. Being the roles that come from creation, that mm-hmm. we were created in such a way. Like I see that a woman is the interior minister. And the man is the foreign minister. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of the interior minister that is in her nature and the best of keeping managing and holding and building the castle. And well, you know, and many women take offense to that because they feel that this is
it's what's valued. And so in other words, the male element gets valued by society and gives a person agency, and the feminine is devalued, as is very witnessed by the fact that if a woman decides to stay home with a child and raise the child, there's no economic value to that by the society. And yet now that we see what it means to have a society that is bereft of caregivers, and yes. we see the cost to society now that people have had to stay home for a year and had to assume a role that has no reward except its intrinsic rewards. It's very similar to music in that musicians do this incredible work that creates incredible value. A place like New York City, you and I have discussed this. New York City is a place-based economy, and what gives it value are the arts.
That's
you
right.
know, culture, dance, even sports, you know, these things that people do that are considered luxury choices for our life are very fundamental, not just to our lives and our well-being, but to our economy, you know. And yet when it comes to who benefits from the care people give, who benefits from the music people make, it isn't usually the creators. It usually isn't the caregiver,
mm-hmm.
the institution.
That's right.
And so, you know, that's an important topic for the future.
That's right. What we're talking about, you know, you said you didn't write for yourself. You're writing archetypes. But,
right.
You know, many times, we are referring to it from our own life. And that's okay. I don't want to dig too much for places you don't want to go to, but I could see that line. And that brings also to this point, doubts. And I wanted to talk about doubts, that short film doubts.
Bring doubts because that has to do with the artistic process. And you make me want to say something, which is you make me realize that the courage of the artist is to go there anyway. And that embarrassment even is a wonderful energy that we avoid. It's the energies that we avoid that are art. And if I wrote from autobiography, I think I could never finish anything because I would know what it comes from. When I write art, I'll go there. I'll go right there. And I won't know how it applies to me until later, you know, when it's obvious, but I won't know until I do know, which is usually after the fact.
So when you write, you create a barrier in your head or in your wherever, however you experience yourself and say,
I don't create a barrier. I create an opening. I open a door.
Well, but the reason I say, okay, thank you. But the reason I say, and the reason I say barriers, because you said, well, I don't write about certain things and I have to be in a certain place to write.
Yeah, I don't write from autobiography.
I'm sorry?
I don't write from autobiography.
Okay, okay.
In that way. You know, I write from, it's as if I open a door and I shapeshift into the conversation energetically that I'm compelled to have.
Yeah.
So the conversation feels as if I say yes to something greater than my own life. And then there are ways that story gets told to me. And of course they're personal, but they don't feel personal. They feel transpersonal when I'm writing.
Okay, so you open the door, but then do you leave the door open? No, because you go back to the other phase. So you close the door. So there is a barrier again. So it depends which end you put the barrier in.
Maybe there's a barrier to my life as Julie. There's a framed context. So I wouldn't say it's a barrier, though, because because it feels like if you were in the room of a house. But I guess a door is a barrier. It depends on how you see it. It does close you in and it does open out, or it does open in, right? So
interesting. So it could reflect the way that I'm using, that I'm saying barrier could reflect on the way that I grew up versus you're talking about the door, the way that you grew up or the way that you experienced life.
I do think that for me, my own life can be a barrier to creating, because I think about things I shouldn't think about when I'm working. In other words, for me, work as an artist is about telling the truth. And if your truth is inconvenient, you need to still tell the truth. If you don't like it, you still need to tell the truth as an artist. I mean, I'm good as a person too, but I'm as a person, if I think my truth is going to be alienating or hurt someone or upset someone, I'm going to mitigate that probably. I'm going to find a better way. But as an artist, I'm not. As an artist, I don't care.
Okay. So you do this barrier because for me personally, I take writing classes in Hebrew, and I dabble here and there in English too. But you know, English is my mother's language, but it's not really, anyway. Never mind. So the thing is that one of the teachers told me if you're thinking whether you should think about it or not, then you should write it.
Yes, I think I know what you mean about that. Like, in other words, the thing you avoid, the resistant place, is the place where the best stuff is.
Yes, yes. Because silence. Silence is, many times people don't know what to do in silence. They cannot handle silence. Like we're talking. And then there is silence. And somebody has all the time the urge to, like, I have to say something. I can't just leave it like that, you know. So doubts. I want to play, please, that wonderful animation. Who did the animation?
Phoebe Cavisi.
Phoebe Cavisi. Okay, it's wonderful. There is doubt.
Doubts. Do not let them in. They eat dreams, color first, but they eat everything, including the skin. Do not let them play. They always win. Doubts get fat on what you fear to love. They are always right there beside you, or sometimes hovering above. Doubts love whispering in your own voice, into your secret ear. Doubts linger, even when they pretend to go away. Even so, they are still near. Doubts will not ever be your friend. They will seduce you. They will lie to you. They will allow you to imagine and pretend whatever is untrue. Doubts live forever. Doubts never end. When a doubt offers you a gloved hand, you must say no. You must not try to understand or to explain. You must not argue. You must not blame. You must continue to be the same or better than you were. Doubts are insidious wherever they occur. They stay stuck in your emotions, and doubts pretend they are an ocean and they invite you to drown. You must hold the doubt down until it stops breathing. If a doubt comes back, make it write you a letter. full of its seething, broken teeth and its false attack. When you see a doubt, turn your back on it. Or, if you must, come right up to it. Break its trust and stare it in the face. Tell a doubt you don't believe it. You will not draw it into being. In fact, you will erase its sneering face until it is a mere smudge. Sometimes, when a doubt is strong, you will be tempted to budge in its direction, to play along, to sing its song. Don't ever play. Doubts will always betray. Instead, conduct an orchestra of belief in your head. Let every instrument sing praise until you raise the horizon and turn a doubt into a pale wraith that fades from view. Court faith, court beauty, court gratitude, and express your happiness in thunderous different ways. When your world goes broken and you have too much room for doubts, remember this. Tell doubts to get out. And instead, invite yourself to receive joy. Invite yourself to perceive what is possible, to what you believe, to what you hope, to what you know and can see to be real. Doubts will steal and eat your dreams, but only if you let them. The best way to defeat them is to leave them and forget them.
So this is really powerful. I've watched it twice, actually before today. I've watched it twice, and it's really powerful. Also, the way that you deliver that, and so here and so true. You know, before we were sitting, I was doubting. I was like, no, maybe didn't I doing this enough? Maybe I didn't do this enough. I'm going to talk to Julie. Julie and Amy, you're like, for years you've been like, what am I going to, you know? And many times the thought, if not all the time, the thought is greater in its negativity than the action itself. It's just the beginning of it. And once you start going in it, it's like the first incline in a roller coaster, you know? It's the scariest one.
Yeah.
So you go up and then once you go down, then it's all. Thank you.
Yeah,
this is a wonderful.
Once you realize. Yeah. And I feel like I don't think that conversation ever goes away, you know, in all the people I've worked with, and I've worked with some really amazingly famous and accomplished people in my coaching work. And I think that what everyone is always saying in their own head is, oh my God, I suck, you know, or some version of that in their language, in their way. They're basically like, am I okay? Do I suck? You know, and artists have that more so because we're more sensitive. So that doubt will stop people from telling the truth. And yet you can't create without that doubt. You need that. It's a friction. It's really the monster under the bed.
Yes, you kind of
need it. You need the terror. You need the terror wall. You need it. You need to keep moving through it. Work stays good because you keep going into new territories.
Yes. Pushing our boundaries. Pushing our boundaries. I mean, I discovered that when we have these boundaries that we can push through, that I can push through, it gives more a sense of a freedom than there is nothing. And you're just like going here, going there, going where, going, but there is something to push through. So in your work, let's touch on your coaching work, because this is like, again, an arc that you started and now you are here in this place. How are you incorporating your art, if you're incorporating your art, into your coaching, into helping people discover the best version of themselves?
You know, it's interesting. I've kept them very separate for most of my life. I haven't really bridged or integrated, except in this way. I'm deeply trained in hypnosis, trance states, flow states, and neurolinguistics. So I know a lot about brain, and I know a lot about the embodiment of transformation. And my first work was coaching people who were working artists, singers, actors, dancers, writers, filmmakers. And those people say yes and a lot. But my current work is often with people who are designing businesses of the future, or lives of the future, or culture, media, technology, different things than I used to work with. and helping people build things that haven't existed before that have a lot of impact on the world. So I'm always working with creative people, but I find that artistic creativity is a divinely aligned conversation with God, let's say, if for lack of a better word, a conversation with God that you really take dictation. You're coming from within. You're expressing something for its own sake because you have to. Mm. And artists need to do it. And they can't do it to please other people. Whereas a business, if you don't have a marketplace, you don't have a business.
That's
so you
right.
have to think outside in, and you have to be creative to that to some extent.
That's
and
right.
then innovate. So depending on what kind of a client I'm helping or what kind of a thing we're doing. So I've helped people in personal ways. For example, I've helped people who have been very, very ill discover miracles of health. That's a very interesting area to work in. And hypnosis is sometimes very effective for that. And I've helped people who are really just incredibly successful in the world deal with the things that come with that, because being very successful means you have different challenges than other people. And there are very few people who can help you, because first of all, they don't believe that you have a problem. And then they don't really know the structure of the problem or how being more successful is more terrifying in many ways than being mediocre.
There is a lot of comparison. So I'm automatically comparing my life to his. So what are you complaining about?
Sometimes people have to navigate different territory. And I really love working with people who have leadership as part of their path. So I've worked with people who are really, really extraordinary. And I've worked with people who are in tremendous pain. And I've done every kind of work I could think of as a healer. And that didn't used to be my career. It used to be my calling. Mm. And it developed into career almost by accident. I still think of it as something of a calling. So even though I may do it in a way that looks like a business, it never is to me. It never is a business.
Yes, no, I hear you.
It's art. It's an art. And you know that because you work with people and you help them find in their own spirit what they need for more good things to happen for them.
Yeah.
I really love that. I really love it. Like every day I get up and I get to experience directly other people creating miracles, and it feels like my own miracle. Their happiness feels like my happiness. It's such a gift to work with people and have good things happen for them and be able to say,
right.
you know.
Yes, right, right. To be happy for somebody.
Yeah, to be so happy for someone. Happy for everybody.
You know, and there are many people that I've encountered that say, no, you cannot be happy for somebody if you're not happy for yourself. Now,
I think happy, you know.
I have a thing with it.
What's your?
Because I've been in these places where things were not manifested in my life. Thank God I'm in a place where in the last several years things have been, thank God, have been wonderful. And I'm sitting here with you and I'm doing this because I love this, and then because I love helping people and I love just showing things and bringing people to the stage. There were times that
button everything. I'm a poet. You can say but.
There were times that things were not working the way that I hoped or wanted, or because I did not feel my energetic presence in that place of abundance. And I still remember that I was happy for this girl that she received what she wanted, or this person that just got a new job. You know, it was, I remember those times, and I have a thing with it. I don't believe that it is not possible, you know, because there is the sentence in Hebrew, ve'ahavta le'recha kamocha. You know, the sentence says, love your neighbor, your friend, like you love yourself. But what it says actually is love to your neighbor like you express love to yourself. Love to, meaning.
Yeah.
First of all, the focus is on me, yes. But love too is, I want for you the best, just like I want for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not about loving you. And yes, it is about loving you, but I don't know you. I haven't been there. I don't know your entire creation, your entire how you are. So it is kind of something that is very difficult. But if I want for you the best, just like I want for me, then yes, I can show this love to you, you know? How do you feel about that?
I mean, I think one of the things that people feel is that if you have a shadow side, you're a bad person. It's just not true. I mean, we all have shitty thoughts and feelings all the time. So what? It's really about your choices and bringing loving kindness towards yourself so that you're nourished enough to be able to love. You know, I mean, I think that the meta prayer, the Buddhist prayer of loving kindness is a really valuable prayer for people to know because it starts in places where it's easy to love. It brings that love back into yourself.
Let's repeat it again because you've been cut off. Your audio suddenly, your audio suddenly is like, you start talking about the Buddhist prayer.
Yes. The prayer of loving kindness. Can you hear it now?
Yes.
That's so funny that that should get interrupted of all things.
Interesting.
It's most important, right?
Interesting.
I was listening to a wonderful teacher, Tara Brach. She's got a book called Radical Compassion. It's beautiful.
Yes.
And, you know, I really think that learning how to love, I mean, like if I were to say to you, Ilan, was how much of the last few years that got better for you came from love, the currency of love in love for yourself and love in your mm-hmm. life. You know, it really mm-hmm. does. Love and courage, you know, are two really important energetics for people. But love doesn't mean you're perfect. I think far from that. I think people encounter themselves and they think there's something wrong if they're hateful or they're jealous or they're angry or whatever. That doesn't mean that. It just means there's something that needs to be changed for you, you know, that.
Yes.
And the faster you bring love to situations, I think the faster they clear and the circumstances clear with them.
Yes, yes, exactly, exactly. Thank God. And wow, what wonderful. What an enriching and a heart-opening conversation is to sit with you here and to hear how you're working and to just talk with you and to feel your energy. So thank you so much for all this. We are at the time, already past the time, but it'll be fun because it's going to be lengthier than usual. And that's wonderful. So this Thursday, please, we will have all the details here this Thursday. What time is it going to be?
It's going to be 8:30 Eastern time, 7:30 Central time.
Yeah, so it's 8:30 Eastern for here in LA. It's 5:30 Pacific. And this is free, and it's a wonderful experience. I really recommend everybody to just take a few moments, a few minutes for you to expand and to just discover something that maybe you're not, just to open to something new, just to be open to something new. You don't have to promise anything, just to open to something new and just experience this marvelous creation of Julie and Carlos.
And Conspirare.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. And this is just wonderful. I've been blessed to hear that, but I'm going to be there again. So, Julie, is there, would like, please, any other last words of encouragement or anything that you want to add here for everybody or about your work?
Yeah,
anything that is.
I do, because I feel that one of the things, because I'm both a teacher and an artist, is, and they don't feel that different to me, is for people who are artists not to give up, you know, to really express yourself. It's a lifelong journey. It's never too late and it's never too early. And if you give yourself the gift of your own presence, your own expressivity, if you move that through the way that it wants to come through you, through your own fingerprint, soul print, whatever, it is important. It is important for the world. You send it out the way you send it out. And look at how many years later I'm meeting this person who came to me, Ilan, through music. And we have a whole world and network of connections now that we can share because he listened and I listened. And really, when you listen to yourself and you put yourself in the world, you're going to find your right place and your right places and your right people.
Amen. Amen. Thank you, Julie Flanders. Thank you so much for being here, for embracing this time and blessing the time together. And for your creation to continue and open hearts and shine yourself to the world and help people. So thank you very much for being here, Julie.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody who's been here. If you know that you missed the show on Thursday, it'll stay up. So the links are still valid. And thank you for being here and for the courage to show up and to be here and to listen. This is Abracadabra, Create What You Speak. I'm Ilan Azulay. I'll see you next week. Litot. Bye-bye.
When the sky is falling and your heart is broken, are the angels calling? When you are
listening to Abracadabra, Create What You Speak, with Ilan Azulay, only on LA Talk Radio.